Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome to the podcast. Today is another in the replay series where we present some of my favourite older episodes for people who may have missed them first time around. This one's from episode 3, way back in 2022. The main content is around the parent-child separation plot in Inception, but we branch off and talk about other movies and music and all sorts of things. It's great content because Derek's such a great guest. And we are planning to do some more episodes on parenting in the movies. But for now, here's the Inception episode from 2022 with Derek McDuff, and I hope you enjoy it.
On this episode of the Fair Parenting Podcast, I'd like to welcome our first ever guest, Derek McDuff from the Underrated Podcast. It's a podcast about movies, and that's what we're going to talk about in this episode. Hello, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on and talk about some of my favorite ever films, because on Underrated, we would never get to talk about these because we just talk about underrated movies. And these are a couple of all-time greats, so I'm glad to talk about them.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, I love your podcast. One of the things with me is I love particularly one of them, Inception, and I've watched that many, many times. But since becoming involved in the family court, it's brought a whole new, I see it in a whole new light, which is, I guess, is in some ways a good test of a film, because you can see it in different levels according to your situation. You know, it's open to interpretation, like a lot of good books and songs and movies and that sort of thing. We're going to talk about two Christopher Nolan films today. The first one is Inception. I saw this many years ago and loved it. But since becoming a parent, I sort of rewatched it again. I realized that there's a sort of a new take on it that you can have as an alienated parent. Basically, the main character, is called Cobb. Basically, he spends the whole movie trying to complete this mission. And the man who hires him says they all get on a plane together from, I think it's Australia to LA. And the man that Cobb is doing the job for says that if he completes the Inception during that plane flight, he will fix all of Cobb's legal problems, and so that he can go back to his children who he left behind in America. Based on that, the whole movie and all of the action is all Cobb's efforts to get back to the two children that he had to leave behind. So from that light, it's got echoes of him being alienated from his children. Have you ever thought about it, Derek, in those lights, or is it just perhaps I'm reading too much into it?
No, I think you're really onto something, because I am not, you know, a parent. I have no plans to ever become one. I don't know really much about legal stuff in general. So this is not a podcast I would have normally have seen myself on. But you came at me with Christopher Nolan, I said, all right, let's do this. So I was very, very excited to talk about these movies. And yeah, I think a really great film like Inception, and I'm the same way as you, this is one of my favorite movies ever. I do watch it. We watch it all the time. It's probably in my top 10 favorite films. I made a list not too long ago of my favorite films of the 2010s, and I think I had it at the top of the list. But yeah, it's like there's this podcast I listen to. I'm a really big fan of The Weekly Planet, if anybody knows that. And it's the guy on it, he talks about how after he became a podcast, he saw all these movies in a new light, like becoming a parent. And that's something that I found really interesting, is like, yeah, that's something that would not necessarily resonate with me. I mean, I get it on like a human level, like this guy just wants to be back with his kids. And that is something that is so, I think that's why Nolan kind of chooses that as a subject in this movie. And, you know, at least one other movie that we're going to talk about is that desire to get back to your children, because that is the most pure bond, like the love of a parent and a child, and the most, you know, there's nothing you can really do to destroy that, really. It's not like a relationship or something where, you know, someone can break up or whatever. It's like, that's for life. it's something that Spielberg touches on in Minority Report with Colin Farrell. Yes. He's talking to he's talking to Tom Cruise, and he's like, a parent losing a child is like the most like blah 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 whatever he says. So I think on that level, it is something that is really obviously going to hit someone with kids and with in a similar situation in so much more of a profound manner.
Yeah. Actually, I watched Minority Report a few weeks ago, but I actually forgot about the relevance of it in to do with what we're speaking about. But you're absolutely right. And there's a line in that where Tom Cruise's ex-wife is talking to the cop who's chasing Tom Cruise.
Danny Whitler.
Yeah. So he goes to Tom Cruise's ex-wife and is basically trying to find out where Tom Cruise is. And at one point she says to him, I left my husband because every time I saw him, I saw my son. And that's the thing, you know, they've lost their son. In the case of that film, they can never get him back because we assume that he's no longer alive, but that really is a powerful film with where Tom Cruise, I don't want to get sidetracked, and perhaps we could do another episode on that film, but it's very powerful the way Tom Cruise, he's got all those slides of his son, hasn't he? And he watches them, and then he sort of dreams. There's that section where he has his eyes removed, doesn't he? His eyes changed. Mm-hmm. And I think during that, while he's recovering, he dreams about the moment where his son disappears in that swimming pool.
Yeah, the last time he sees him.
Yeah. And again, I saw that film. I was like, okay. But then, yes, as a parent, it does hit you, especially if one where somebody's trying to take your child away from you. It does hit you on a level that I hadn't recognized before. And another really good film of Spielberg's around that time is AI. And that's almost a reverse, where it's the child wanting to get back to his mum. There's a really good scene. Again, I actually ought to do another episode, but there's a really good scene at the end where they bring his mother back, the aliens, but they can only do it for one day. And so he gets to spend one day with his mother. And poignant, you know, the way it's done. But anyway,
I was just going to say real quick, like you could do a whole thing about Spielberg, because Spielberg, you know, being a child of divorce, he like almost every one of his movies, at least most of them are like have a bit of like divorce in them. Like Jurassic Park famously is like the grandkids are coming there after a divorce, and Alan Grant kind of is a disgruntled guy. He doesn't want kids, and he learns how to become like a good father. Then that same arc repeats in like the next three Jurassic Park movies. And World of the Worlds is another one. Like there's a lot of that in Spielberg. I think he just kind of copes with a lot of his being a child of divorce in his movies over and over again.
I was watching E.T. with my child a couple of months ago. It's the first time my child had seen E.T. And that was a really magical experience, because E.T. scared my daughter initially. You know, when you see him creeping up the stairs for the first time, my daughter said, I don't like it, you know. But but within 5 minutes of seeing E.T., she was in love with him. And by the end of the story, she was jumping up and down at the TV. You know, she really loved it. And I watched a YouTube interview with Spielberg about E.T. afterwards. And you know, there's a scene in that film where they talk about the father who's gone to Mexico or something, and the children miss him. And Spielberg was sort of saying that was kind of, you know, harked back to his childhood and had some echoes there. Does your podcast cover those, or are they, because Spielberg's another one who's not really underrated?
Yeah, I don't think there's any Spielberg movies that would qualify as underrated.
Yeah.
I don't think, maybe like War Horse or something, you know, that.
Yes.
And we've covered some other big names like Scorsese when he did his film Silence, which was a big box office flop. But I don't think there's been ever really a Spielberg flop or one that wasn't critically beloved, other than maybe 1942, which I wouldn't want to cover that anyway.
I only saw that once. I liked it. Back to Inception, I've listed many parenting scenes that, again, they kind of washed over me when I wasn't a parent. But so I sort of rewatched the film yesterday, and I was amazed at how much it sort of come out. You know, there's early on, Cobb calls his children. They're asking about him, when is he coming back? And we hear the grandmother in the background telling the children he's never coming back. And he then asks to speak to the grandmother, and she hangs up on him. And there's that sense that the children are being cared for by an in-law, who's hostile to the father, and he's finding it very difficult to even maintain a phone relationship with his children. Again, yeah, I think a lot of alienated parents can relate to that, because it's not always just the parents that alienate. Often they're helped by their, you know, relatives and friends, and it can seem as if you're up against a whole wall of opposition. And I really got that when I saw Cobb trying to talk to his children. I don't know. I'm assuming that the grandmother was, because she had a French accent in the scene, and so I'm just lazily assuming that that was Moll's mother.
That's what I think the implication is supposed to be. And I think Michael Caine is supposed to be Moll's dad.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah.
Implicitly clear. Like, I mean, I guess they're both European. Like, that makes sense. And, like, it doesn't seem like he's definitely not Cobb's dad. So that would be the only other option, I guess. So.
Yeah. Well, he's working in Paris as well. So maybe that is a link.
Yeah.
Although you'd have to say, well, what? Maybe they've split up. I don't know. But who knows?
That's what I was kind of guessing. But that whole thing, it's interesting because, this isn't something that I don't know. Would probably not be relatable to alienated parents in the real world, but it's something that is interesting in the film, which is that the grandmother definitely blames him for the death of Moll, and Michael Caine does not. And I think that he is somewhere in the middle, where he realizes that he is implicit, but was not intentional. It wasn't direct, but he doesn't know what options he had, but the option that he took was maybe not the best one because of what it led to. And I love that scene where he's talking to Elliot Page and he says something like, I can't go back because they think I killed my wife. Thank you for not asking if I did. And I think the scene kind of just cuts there. So he's definitely still feeling the guilt for that. And he's reckoning with, you know, the consequences of that decision throughout the entire movie. And the struggle to kind of get back to his kids. And just to add off that a little bit, I think that the way Moll is portrayed in this movie is really interesting, where she is just kind of this femme fatale, just kind of like dark character. And on a surface level, that seems like maybe bad or lazy writing, or, you know, that whole trope of Nolan can't really write women. But I think that on closer inspection, especially towards the end, it becomes apparent that this is his projection of Moll, and he can never really imagine her like she was. And this is her, you know, just like kind of the thoughts. And you hear various things about her, like Eames says that she was lovely, and you get all these different information. You're like, well, you can never really know what she was really like and where the projection ends, and just how this figure is just driven completely by his guilt. And I think that really ties into a lot of the stuff that Nolan is doing overall with the movie, what he's saying about being a creative, being a screenwriter and director. And it's like, yeah, when you have these, you bring these ghosts from your past and these things from your real life, they are always going to be shaded by your own feelings about them.
Yeah, that's a really good insight, because she only exists in his dreams at that point. Mm-hmm. So you're right. One thing about Michael Caine is the conversation they have in Paris, him and Cobb, it leads me to believe that Michael Caine might have been the one that got Cobb into doing the dream exploration into Inceptions.
Yeah.
Because Cobb goes to him and says, I need a new architect. And Michael Caine says, well, he says, I need one as good as I was. And Michael Caine says, I've got one better.
No, I think he says, he directly tells him, like, he's like, I didn't teach you to do, like, to steal the people's dreams and stuff like that. And he says, he's like, well, he's like, he talks about, like, basically he says he was the one who taught him to go into people's dreams. However, he was not the one, like, teaching him to be an extractor / inceptor and stuff like that.
Right. Yes. Yes. So he's probably got a deeper understanding of probably what can go wrong than the mother in America, or the grandmother. Yeah, because I think Cobb, he gave her the idea that the children aren't real, or in the dream, all this. But I don't think he realized that she would take that back to reality with her. So
exactly.
I think it was just a tragic mistake on Cobb's part.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think in that section, he says that they've been dreaming for 50 years. And so you know, probably a good time to wake up.
Yeah.
I don't think we
can. Yeah, they had, like he says, like, we had a life, you know, like she's kind of like, oh, we never got to, and he's like, we grew old together. We experienced so much, you know, just the two of us, but I had to, that's the first time he tries to go back to his children. That's what it's originally driven by. His desire to go back and see his kids that they had left behind, which, you know, for the kids, it was only, you know, a few minutes, but for them, it had been an entire lifetime almost.
Yes. I don't know. There is another to do with the children and the dream sequences. We never see their faces until the end. They always appear to be running or playing, and you only see the backs of their heads until right at the end. But I'll come back to that in the end, because there's another thing I want to mention. I don't know too much about Christopher Nolan. I think he does have children, but I don't know what ages they are, or I don't know if he has experience at a family court. But there seemed to be, in at least a couple of his films, this idea of a parent being separated from a child. And I mean, it happens so much in the real world. It may be that, you know, a friend or relative went through it and he saw him, the stress, or you know, who knows? But it does seem as something that he's very interested in, but I've never seen it written about.
Yeah, as far as I know, and I'm there is something I kind of want to touch on more on that with Interstellar, so I'll save some of my thoughts. But I do think it is that just kind of, yeah, it is the purest kind of just, you know, the love, even more than the reverse, a parent for their kids' love is just kind of the most, it's something that everyone can like understand as being a driving factor. You don't need to explain away why there is this love or anything. It's just implicitly there. You don't need to really give too much drive to that motivation. So I think that it is the most universal and understood kind of compassion and love, and you know why you would go through this entire thing. You know, like if you have something like in Star Trek, Wrath of Khan, when you see Kirk and Spock, when Spock dies, that means something to us because we have so many years of them being friends. And if we just dropped into that movie, we'd be like, why do these guys care about each other so much? But you can kind of drop someone into like, oh, this is my kid. You don't need like 15 seasons of a TV show. You can just be like, okay, we get it.
Right. Yeah, so we need to have gone on that journey with Kirk and Spock to know why, get the meaning. But you're saying with the parent and child, you don't need to. Yeah, I get that. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
And something else that occurred to me yesterday when I was watching the film that I totally missed. There's another parent-child relationship in this film that is key, and that's between Robert Fisher and his dad. Now, they don't seem to have a great relationship for whatever reason, but the whole project that Cobb's embarking on is to get Robert Fisher to destroy his dad's empire. I don't think Fisher wanted to do that at the start, even though he had a bad relationship with his dad. I think, you know, the whole idea was that he would carry on with the empire. Cobb is actually being destructive there. In Cobb trying to get back to his own children, he's actually making a parent-child relationship for another person, for Robert Fisher, worse. Even though Robert Fisher's father's died, he still had the memories, he still had the legacy. But Cobb, to get back to his children, is getting Fisher to actually just destroy that legacy.
So, well, here's the thing, though, about that I think is really interesting, is originally they're kind of like, okay, they're talking about how do we get this inception, this idea into him. And Tom Hardy's character says, oh, well, let's get him to do this as a kind of screw you to the old man, because they've had this aggressive relationship. But then Cobb is like, you know what? I think we got to make him, like, it has to be a positive thing. He's like, we're going to basically give him a positive memory of his dad. And the memory is going to be like, oh, I'm not going to do this despite my dad. I'm going to do this because I want to, you know, my dad is wants me to build something for myself, to do it on my own. And my dad is proud of me, which is something that probably isn't true in reality. But he's like, I think one thing that Cobb says that always sticks with me is he's like, I think positive emotion trumps negative emotion every time. Yes. And I love that that's the angle that they take, that they're like, okay, we're going to take this broken relationship between this dad who's not a good dude, like he's a pretty bad parent, like objectively if you look at it, and this son who's been kind of traumatized by this, and he's like, we're going to like basically give him free therapy and like give the son something positive out of this relationship and allow him to go forward and build something new for himself. and not be shackled by the trauma that he received from his dad, and to kind of look back at that in a more fond light. And I think that was a really cool, powerful theme for me.
Yeah, I'd missed that. That's a great insight. Yeah. I mean, of course, they could have given him a positive memory and idea and got him to build his father's empire even more. So they've kind of used a positive thing to get him to destroy the empire. But
yeah. You do kind of like it in watching this movie. You can watch it and be like, okay, they're good guys. Or like, are they just like selfish, like capitalists, just like, you know, trying to grab everything? Like, they're helping out this, is Saito really, are they like going to stop in a monopoly, or are they just helping like one company get up a leg up over another company? You could read it a bunch of different ways. And it's like what you said before, like you reading this movie differently as a parent. You can read this movie so many different ways. And that's one thing I really love about it.
Yeah. I hadn't thought that they're giving him something powerful. I think in practice, they don't really care what they do. Like you say, the positive memory trumps the negative one. I think if the negative memory had been more likely to succeed, they would have done that. But you're right. That is something they've done. So probably I was wrong in what I said. They probably have left Robert Fisher with a more positive memory of his father, even though he is going to destroy the empire.
Yeah, and he has that like quick line where he talks about exposing his father's partner, who's played by Tom Berenger, as being kind of a snake in the grass. So I'm like, okay, cool. They kind of at least, you know, helped him out with this other really negative influence in his life, you know, kind of realizing that this person is not the greatest.
Yeah, there's a powerful scene between Fisher and his dad where the dad's on the hospital bed, and I think it might be, is it the Tom Berenger character? He sees a picture get pushed onto the floor and he says, oh, that must have been a cherished memory. And Robert Fisher says, I put it there, he hasn't even noticed. Obviously, Fisher is trying to repair his relationship with his dying father, but it's not successful in real life.
Yeah.
Well, there's two main parental child stories going on in that film.
Well, one thing too, before we move on from that picture, is I don't know if you guys, but then when he goes in the safe, the thing that he finds in the safe is that little pinwheel from the picture. Yes. And I love that, because they keep talking about, we have to, like, he's going to do it himself. He has to kind of, that whole ending is like, he has to incept himself pretty much. That's the only way it's going to work. And they don't find the pinwheel or anything. Like, I guess maybe they do for a second, but like, it is all about him going in there by himself, and they give him all the tools to repair this relationship, but he has to be the one to do it in the end.
Yeah, I actually got that what's in the safe is what's in the picture, so that's really good, a really good link. When Moll commits suicide in real life, one thing she says that I'd missed before is she says she's going home to their real children, because she actually believes that that is her, the dream is her reality. And so there's another parental story there. She's killing herself because she wants to go home to her real children. Yeah, it's very powerful that she would actually do that to get back to them. But then she leaves, you know, once she's gone, she leaves Cobb in an unfortunate situation where he's at home with his children and there's some sort of assistant there. And he says to Cobb, it's now or never. And that's the last time Cobb sees his children until the very end. That's the point at which he flees America. You know, Inception becomes his only way back. When he finds this job, he knows that he's got two choices. He can do the job on the plane, at which point, once the job's complete, his name will get cleared by some sort of electronic means. Or if the job fails, he's going to land. I think the words he uses is, if I complete this job and you don't honor your word, I'm going to jail for the rest of my life. Because there's a phrase used in Inception a couple of times about taking a leap of faith. And Cobb is doing that. He can live a free life outside of America and probably quite a lucrative one with the skills that he has. But he wants so much to see his children. He embarks on this risky mission. And he recruits a team. It's a big endeavor. But at the end of the day, it comes down to a gamble. If he doesn't complete that job on the plane, the authorities will put him in jail for the rest of his life. So it's a hell of a risk.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, something that comes up again and again in this movie is just like, he doesn't know. He's got to take it on faith that like this will work and that he's going to get to see his kids again. And it's something that a lot of characters mention. It's this kind of recurring, like you said, line that keeps getting repeated. And there are moments when it is kind of portrayed that, like, hey, maybe taking a leap of faith is a dangerous, difficult thing, because Maul, like you mentioned before, literally takes a leap of faith that she is still dreaming.
Yeah,
like a literal leap. And, you know, so that's a negative leap of faith. And he doesn't take that leap. And I think the movie I have the interpretation that he does get back to his kids in the end and everything, but you can take the interpretation that the entire movie is a dream and that Maul was right, and then they were still dreaming and she got back to her kids. So there's all these different lenses you can look through the movie at, but as a viewer, you even have to take a leap of faith that what you are being shown is the kind of true story, and that he is getting back to his kids at the end.
Yeah, I mean, we might as well leap forward to the end now, because basically what happens when they get on the plane is the inception. It's the action part and trying to give this idea to Robert Fisher. I love that line, actually, where they put Robert Fisher's plane out of commission, and they're talking about how you would do Inception on a plane. And they're saying, oh, we need a 747 or something like that. Saito says, I bought the airline. It seems simpler.
I love that. So, Ken Watanabe is such a great actor. Like, I love Ken Watanabe. He's amazing.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
And the delivery of that line is just so, he's just like, I bought the airline. It seemed clear, man. It's just like, it's so cool.
Yeah. Then they wake up, they do the inception, and there's a great scene where Cobb just wakes up and he just stares really intently at Saito, who then grabs the phone to make the call that will hopefully clear things with the authorities for when they land.
That look that he gives, like, there's so much meaning, because they're both waking up after like 80 years and they're like, like, you know, when you wake up from a dream, you're like, oh man, this is the real world, and you've been asleep for 8 hours. That's what they're doing. But after like almost a century, who knows how long, you know?
Yeah. It's a great scene, and nobody speaks in it. All of them wake up and they all look at each other. You know, some of them are happy, and Cobb's obviously quite stressed. It's such an intense stare that he gives. Yeah. And the job at that point is over for most of them, but it's not for Cobb, because around the time of them waking up, I think Hans Zimmer's instrumental called Time starts playing. And I think that then plays for the remainder of the film. I think that from that point to the end of the film is maybe 5 minutes, something like that. And it's a great piece of music. Very simple, a lot of Hans Zimmer stuff. It's simple, but it's just so powerful.
And my absolute favorite composer, for sure. And I will say real quick that I got to see him at Coachella a couple of years ago, which was a mind-blowing, cool experience. And Time is the song that he ended with. And it was so freaking cool and just so great to get to experience that. I think he won the Oscar for this movie, for best score.
Wow. Yeah, it is incredible. I have a certain playlist on my phone that sort of helps me when I'm down, sort of thing. And that's on it. I mean, it's got to be most people's, obviously. But so in the film, that theme's playing. They've all woken up and you see the arrivals hall at the air, I guess, LAX. And Cobb walks up to the immigration lawyer immigration official, hands the passport. And at that point, he doesn't know if he's going to go to jail. But the guy, I don't know the guy who plays the immigration official, but he's got this sort of, world-weary look on him. He's probably, he's only in it for a brief second, but it's a really good piece of acting, because you can just imagine, you know, he looks like he's greeted about 10,000 people that day and he's looking to go home. And I think he just gives him back the passport and says, welcome home, or something like that. And Cobb walks off, and all the other members of the team are there and they're all watching. And then we next see Cobb arrive home and Michael Caine's there. We don't see the grandmother, but Michael Caine's there, and we see the children's faces for the first time, and they rush over to their dad and he picks them up. And of course, he's got his little spinning totem that he places on or spins on the table. That's kind of the end of the movie. He's got the children in his arms. He's done the job. All is well, we hope. We don't.
That's a brilliant. It ends an ambiguous note.
It's a brilliant ending. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And I guess, are there a lot of theories as to what happens there, or is it was Christopher Nolan perhaps leaving it open for a sequel, or
I don't think he was leaving it for a sequel. There are, like, if you like look on the internet, there are countless theories about people like, oh well, this, it wobbles, so that means that it must be, you know, real, but no, it strains itself. So like, there's just people like over analyzing every single frame of that, which I think misses the entire purpose of that shot, is that it's supposed to be like, we don't know, like we're supposed to be like, it could be a dream, but it doesn't matter to him at that point, because he has gotten back to what he believes are his kids. Like, he has accomplished his goal. This is all he's been living for, is to get back to his kids. And he kind of doesn't care if it's real or not anymore. He spins the top, but he ignores it. He doesn't care. And I think that people who do overanalyze the ending and have all the theories like, well, his ring is actually his totem, which maybe actually is true. But like, I think they're kind of missing the point of that scene.
Well, I'd like to think that that it was reality and he got home. And
me too.
Just from my point of view. One just quick thing, that he, in the dream sequences where he goes down each level, I think the first level's a week and the second level's 10 years, is it? And the third level's 50 years. Something that I don't know, I forget the amounts of time, but, you know, from somebody who's missing their child in real life, each level that he goes down, he's missing them for a lot longer. You know, for example, right at the bottom level where he goes to get Saito, I mean, that could be 10 years. I don't know how long they're down there, but that's more and more time that he's without his children. So he's living a multiple of what somebody in reality would be living without their children. I mean, it's a bit like something like Groundhog Day, or, you know, how long is Bill Murray trapped in that one day? We don't know, but it's a long time. And it's similar here. We don't know how long these Inception jobs take. Yeah,
and it's interesting because it's absolute inverse of what we're about to talk about with Interstellar, because with Interstellar, like, Nolan, you can tell, really had a lot to say and a lot to think about all this time stuff. And with that one, he's losing time. Like, he's like, okay, if I'm on this planet for, what is it, every hour is 7 years? And then he knows that the more time he spends, it's becoming exponentially more and more and more time that he's losing to get back to his daughter. So I think the way he does the two opposites with these two movies that we're talking about here, and the way time is played with, is really cool and interesting and really existential. It's interesting that you bring up Groundhog Day, because I was just guessing on another podcast about Groundhog Day and just kind of the existential nature of that. And we also talked about, because it was like a series where we talked about three different movies, one of the other ones we talked about is Eternal Sunshine. So like, back to back with Inception, there are so many, well, they're very, very different movies. There are so many like things about them that are similar, like they're both going into dreams, they are both seeing these projections of their significant other, but it's not really them, it's just their idea of them. So a lot of really cool parallels, and I think that it plays on the existential nature of time and dreams. That's something that lends itself really naturally to existentialism in film, and that's one thing that I really love about this movie.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Eternal Sunshine, because I haven't seen that. I only saw it once when it came out. And if I remember rightly, it came out a year or two before Inception. And
it was 2004. Inception, it was 2010.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, six years then. Yeah. I remember when I first saw Inception, I thought of Eternal Sunshine, but, you know, it's probably over 15 years since I saw that film now, so I can hardly remember it. I would have to go back and watch that film. But I remember at the time I first saw Inception, I did remind me of a little bit of Eternal Sunshine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
But since then, I you know, Inception kind of overwhelmed me, and I watched that a lot fairly regularly, and I actually totally forgot about Eternal Sunshine, funnily enough, because that whole film's about erasing memories, isn't it?
So, those are two movies that I regularly go back to. And it's funny, Eternal Sunshine is a movie, I came out when I was like 14, and I watched it a lot and I loved it a lot. But it's one of those movies that when I got older and I had been through like a few breakups and stuff, I was like, oh man, like, I am getting this whole other level. Like you talked about, like with, you know, your kids and this one.
Yeah.
That's how I felt like watching Eternal Sunshine. Yeah. I was like, I get this on a whole other level now.
Yeah, totally. So, Derek, thanks very much for coming on the podcast today. It's been really great. Tell us where we can listen to your underrated show.
Yeah, so like you mentioned at the start, you know, I do my podcast, Underrated, me and a couple friends. You know, we're called The Undercast Company. We talk about underrated and underappreciated films. So we have a lot of fun with that because we get to talk about movies that wouldn't normally be covered on other movie podcasts. I do some other stuff. I do a lot of freelance writing and stuff. You can find some of my writing on Medium or places like Watch Mojo that I've written for. So check me out there or check out any of my podcasts you can listen to just by looking up Undercast Company on all the podcast apps. So however you're listening to this, we're on Spotify, YouTube, of course, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, all the stuff. Just look up Undercast Company or Underrated and you'll find me or look me up on as Derek McDuff and you'll might be able to find some of my writing on places like Medium.
Great. Okay. And do you have a website or social media links that people can find?
Yeah. So I have a Linktree, just linktree.com/Derek McDuff. And that's got a list of all of my different places you can check me out. You know, I'm on Instagram, just Derek McDuff on all those places. Derek's_photos on Instagram, but pretty much Derek McDuff just everywhere else that you would find me. I'm on Letterboxd. If you guys want to follow me and check out some of my ratings and reviews of movies, I post a lot. Some stuff on Letterboxd as well. If you want to just look up Derek, I think it's what am I on Letterboxd? Derek89 or something like that. Yeah.
Okay, that's great. That wraps up this episode. So thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.